The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Tuesday, December 27th, 2016. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. It's one of our best of shows of 2016.
Matt's influencing you a lot.
I'm doing this for people who are actually speeding it up. And they're like, wait a second. How come his voice fast, but the music's not? Best of 2016 on the program today. Economist Mark Blight on the politics of Brexit and what ultimately be Donald Trump's victory. Also, Amanda Taub on authoritarians amongst us. Boy, I guess we were a little prescient during the year.
Wrong on prediction. Right on prescience.
Right. Very prescient. Just, we had all the tea leaves. We just didn't read them right.
I ranked them wrong.
We would write them wrong. And then for members, we have a deep archive of the Majority Report from back in the Janine Garofalo and I days. Where we're talking to the great Thomas Frank on his book, What's the Matter with Kansas? And that's from 04, folks. That's 12 years ago. Holy crap, hola. Almost 12 years to the day. Jeez, oh, Pete.
Not good.
I've been doing this for too long. But you wouldn't know it because I don't have a scraggly beard.
Wow.
And why don't I have a scraggly beard?
See, that's when you sit back for the sensei right there.
There you go. Why don't I have a scraggly beard? Because I am cleanly shaven with my favorite brand of razor, Harry's. Now, to be honest with you, I am still probably in Michigan. Yeah, I'm coming back today, but I'm still in Michigan. I've probably shaved while I'm there, although I've also anticipated being drunk the entire time, and that is not a good mix. But
Xanax, alcohol, and shaving, you might want to be circumspect on that.
Exactly. Or you might want to live on the edge. And talk about great edges. This is a 5 German-engineered blade. It's got a lubricating strip, flex hinge for a comfortable glide, trimmer blade for hard-to-reach places, which is good. So if you know you have that problem, like you can't, you got to shave around the nose. Get into the nostril.
The nose from a certain region, certain background.
There's nothing I bet our sponsors love more than some good ethnic humor. Honestly, you folks know I love Harry's, so it doesn't matter. It's coming from the heart. For $2 a blade compared to $4 you'll pay at the drugstore. Harry's is so confident in the quality of their blades. And I gave both my brother-in-laws, coming back from Michigan now, but that's what they got for Christmas.
They must love it. They must have loved it.
I mean, I'm assuming. So Harry's is so confident in the quality of their blades, they want you to try their most popular trial set for free. Comes with a razor handle of your choice, a 5-blade cartridge, and shaving gel. It's free when you sign. Is this right? Are they giving this away free now? You're kidding. You get it free when you sign up. You just pay for shipping. I wonder if this means this is the end of their run with us. I mean, this is, they're giving away the store, literally.
Keep escalating.
Wow. And there's a special offer for fans of the show. You go to harrys.com right now and enter the code MAJORITYREPORT at checkout to get a post-shave balm added to your order for free. What? You got to pay for the shipping for this, but that's not even pocket change. That's harrys.com, code MAJORITYREPORT. That's a great deal.
It's incredible. Harry's is great. They're the indispensable razor.
All right, folks. So enjoy today's show. We got a double shot, Blythe and Taub. And maybe two sides of the same coin in some respects. Not necessarily. No, I don't think that's accurate. But also, we may have sprinkled in a little bit of comedy, Matt's stylings. And then members, you'll get that... that amazing Thomas Frank interview. We've got some amazing member stuff throughout the week. Lewis Lapham, from 05 talking about fascism. Thomas, Helen Thomas, that amazing AP reporter.
Iconic.
Famous, iconic. And Janine interviewed her back in the day. Howard Zinn. Whoa. Oh, you got to be kidding me.
Who's Howard Zinn?
You can get all of that by becoming a member at majority, jointhemajorityreport.com. Jointhemajorityreport.com. You'll get all this member stuff. Even if you order, like, even if you get this later in the week, you can go back and you'll have archives. You can get the app at majorityapp.com and then search all the archives. You'll love it, folks. It's just pennies a day. But enjoy today's program. We got some other great material for you, best of this week. Talk to you tomorrow. Yep. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome staff writer for Vox.com, Amanda Taub, on her most recent piece. I believe it was. It was definitely a huge piece. The Rise of American Authoritarianism. Welcome to the program, Amanda.
Thanks, Sam. It's so great to be here.
So, all right, let's. This is obviously incredibly timely. And to no coincidence, I guess, about that. But let's start with just what we have learned and talk a little bit about the development of these theories. And I should say right off that, you know, we spoke to Jonathan Weiler, who you cite, at least having written a book. We spoke to him about 4 or 5 years ago on that book that he had put out at the time, because this was it was definitely a sense that this was out there. But tell us what we know, or what, I guess, authoritarianism is in general.
Sure. So when political scientists talk about authoritarianism, what they're really talking about is a kind of psychological disposition that makes people crave order and really be very attached to hierarchies and social stability. And when there is a lot of social change or these people feel otherwise threatened, they're much more likely to want to support leaders who we might think of as kind of the authoritarian in the colloquial sense. So the kind of strongman figure who says, oh, you know, your problems are all due to XYZ group and we're going to do whatever it takes. We're going to use force. We're going to use extreme policies, whatever it takes to rid ourselves of the problem. And so what political scientists like Jonathan Weiler, who you just mentioned, his co-author Mark Hetherington, and some other people who study this have found is that, first of all, you can test for this disposition. You can ask people 4 questions about their parenting preferences, which actually are very revealing about how they value things like hierarchies, order, authority, stability, etc.
All right, wait, I just want to back up just a little bit. I mean, because this has been, all right, so just to be clear for folks to understand, when we're talking about authoritarianism, we're actually talking about the followers, right? I mean, we're talking about,
right.
I mean, I guess it's just sort of, colloquially speaking, we talk about the leaders. But in this context, we're talking about a personality trait. I mean, what, and for a long time, I mean, this research, which sort of, I guess, tests for this disposition is relatively new. Explain why it was so hard, because there's this concept has been out there, right? I mean, since basically
absolutely
World War II, I guess, was the big example of people are asking the question like, you know, I mean, this is Hannah Arendt stuff, right? I mean, the, how did people do this?
Right. So you're completely correct. This is a field of study that began after World War II with political scientists, sociologists, other researchers, essentially trying to explain the Nazis and how anti-Semitism and fascism and those types of political forces became so powerful and so damaging in Europe during World War II. But the field really struggled for a long time to be rigorous and quantitative because these are very sensitive questions. You know, you can't ask somebody, do you support the Nazis? You can't ask somebody, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10, how racist do you think you are? How much do you fear groups who aren't like you? And expect them to give honest or reliable answers because those are just such sensitive topics. And also they're very subjective.
Right.
But then what a researcher named Stanley Feldman, as well as his colleague, a woman named Karen Stenner, figured out is you could ask people these four parenting questions and they would reveal their kind of deeper preferences and priorities. And those answers correlate very strongly with what Feldman calls the action side of authoritarianism. So that is support for authoritarian leaders and authoritarian policies. And I would just say that, you know, when you think about the kind of classical authoritarian leader, it is somebody who is, you know, they're very forceful. They have a political style that is very punitive. It's very focused on kind of finding somebody to blame and promising to punish them harshly for it. And what researchers like Feldman, Weiler, and Mark Hetherington told me when I spoke to them is that Donald Trump really fits the kind of classic image of the authoritarian political style. So the two sides of this are, on the one hand, the political disposition and psychological disposition among the supporters, why people would want to support a leader like that. But then the other side of it is this action side, political policies and politicians who suit this authoritarian demeanor and right. kind of suit the
I want to put a pin in that because I want to ask, I want to talk about whether or not, you know, in the absence of Trump, what, mm-hmm. you know, who would have stepped into that role, or are there other people competing for that role in the Republican Party, or, you know, let's be fair, in the Democratic Party? I know that's not the case, but I'm going to pretend
well,
like
you know,
I want to get there because I know that we have, okay. we at least have authoritarians who are in both parties, but let's,
right.
I want to go through these questions about parenting because I think, not only, obviously, are they sort of fascinating just to, you know, to find out how you sort of measure this for somebody. And, you know, I mean, this is one of those things where you could sort of see this in like, you know, in lifestyle magazines, too, for, you know, just do you just check out whether or not you should be asking this of your potential life partner on some level. But it also, I mean, it also, I think, sort of just gives a sense of what authoritarians are seeking. One is, please tell me what you think is more important for a child to have, independence or respect for elders. Presumably, I'm just guessing here, but respect for elders is what an authoritarian would choose, right? I mean,
that's right.
Yeah, don't tell me that beforehand because I want to see what my tendencies are.
Okay.
Please tell me which one you think is more important for a child to have, obedience or self-reliance. Now, my heart says self-reliance. I deal with the child all the time. I mean, frankly, you know, my answer to all these questions would be like, do I have to have a child? But I have two, and so that's just the way it is. So I'm going to go self-reliance on that. But obedience would be what an authoritarian wants, right?
That's right.
And then please tell me what you think is more important for a child to have, to be considerate or well-behaved. I would say be considerate because just don't be a jerk. And well-behaved implies like, you know, you don't talk unless you're talked to. I presume well-behaved is the authoritarian. And lastly, please tell me which one you think is more important for a child to have, curiosity or good manners. And I would say, of course, curiosity.
it. I mean, it's so strange because I have a feeling of the vast majority of people listening to that go like, those are slam dunk questions. like, you know, it's like immediately you see right through this. Of course, nobody wants their kid to be a little robot. But the interesting thing is that it goes both ways, right? Like, as a parent, if I'm authoritarian, I want my kids to just be part of a hierarchy so that I'm middle management, right? And presumably there's higher management, right? That could, I guess, theoretically be, if I'm a woman, my husband, and then if I'm a husband, it would be maybe my boss, and maybe then God or the, you know, or Donald Trump.
Yeah, you know, I think the specifics of what hierarchies people are envisioning when they answer these questions are really kind of beyond the scope of this test. What's really going on here is all of these questions are asking people to weigh two values against each other. And roughly speaking, in each case, the value is something along the lines of how important is it for somebody to kind of follow their own beliefs and values versus how important is it for them to follow the rules that society lays out. So with parenting, the rules are the ones that the parents make. So, you know, you're asking questions about obedience. The same with good manners. You know, good manners are about following kind of society's rules for good behavior versus being, you know, curious and figuring out what you want to know, regardless of whether it's really socially acceptable. And the same with, you know, the difference between being considerate and being well-behaved. I think there are very few parents out there who would say, you know, I don't want my child to be considerate, or I don't want my child to be well-behaved. Most people value both of those things, but which one you value more says a lot about how important you think rules are.
And what, to what extent does this stuff correlate with Orthodox religion, with fundamentalism?
So I have to say that's actually not something that we tested for. So in the article that you mentioned, we asked people a lot of questions about other kind of values and concerns that they have and other policy preferences. We didn't ask them about those type of religious questions because actually that's another area where one person's idea of what fundamentalism means is very different from somebody else's. And so it really would have been kind of beyond the scope of what we were doing in terms of social science.
You'd have to develop a whole sort of like another test for just whether or not they are in fact sort of a fundamentalist, I guess.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, I don't know if that would be the same across all religions. So I think that that is the kind of question that actually gets very difficult to test for accurately. So I can't really say.
All right. And so what is there something unique about, before we go into sort of like, you know, sort of how authoritarianism actually works. Well, maybe we should go into that first and then we'll go into, but there were three, once you determine whether or not someone has that sort of tendency, I guess, there are three insights here about authoritarians. The first is deals with polarization. The second deals with the concept of activation, and then the third has to deal with basically how you can be, an ad hoc authoritarian. Let's start with this notion of polarization. Authoritarians used to be fairly well dispersed, I guess, through our political spectrum, and that's not the case so much anymore, is it?
That's right. So this is actually something that Hetherington and Weiler found when they were researching political polarization, which is that over the past few decades, authoritarians have been filtering more and more into the Republican Party. And they suggest that the reason for this is that the Republican Party has positioned itself as kind of the champion of traditional values. And because authoritarians feel kind of threatened and anxious about social change, that's a very kind of appealing position for them to perceive. And so, you know, since basically the civil rights movement, women's rights, things like same-sex marriage, over and over, the Republican Party has kind of positioned themselves against those changes, and that has appealed to authoritarians. So what that means is that there's just this big constituency now within the Republican Party of authoritarian voters that is becoming a kind of bigger and bigger base of potential votes that Republican politicians can appeal to.
And so, and that ties into this second theory of activation. So we already have this sort of notion out there that folks are under attack in some way from social change. I mean, I think, you know, I describe conservatives as sort of like a 24/7, 365 living in Masada, where they are convinced that the hordes are out there to get them, and it's life or death behind the walls of their barricade. And then you talk about this theory of activation, which I imagine you have this sort of like notion of social change that provides this sort of low grade anxiety that they're under siege, and then 9/11 happens.
So, yeah, it's not just 9/11, but it's kind of any kind of frightening change. So this is research from a political scientist named Karen Stenner. And what she found in her work was that authoritarianism as a kind of, you know, personal disposition can be latent. It can sort of, somebody could have those values, but it might not actually affect their political preferences if it's not a time of kind of stress and social change. So people with that disposition can be what she called activated by high stress, which could be social change, it could be economic stress, it could be something like terrorism. You just mentioned 9/11. That was obviously very frightening for people of all kinds in this country. And when that happens, they respond by kind of having more actively authoritarian political preferences. So that could mean supporting a kind of strongman leadership style. It could mean supporting authoritarian policies, such as those that sacrifice civil liberties or other kinds of personal freedoms in the hope that it will prevent terrorist attacks. And so that's why this can become a more potent political force at certain times.
So we have this idea of, so I guess maybe the social anxiety is also of the same kind, I guess, as, you know, sort of this notion of like existential anxiety, right? So it could be just, you know, gays are getting married and the Muslims, you know, or ISIS is coming for us. Those have the same type of impact. Is there also sort of like a set of sort of personal things? I mean, can somebody gets divorced, lose a job, would also play into sort of activating this?
So I'm actually not sure about that. That's largely because in our own polling, we were trying to focus on more kind of broad national issues to find out what might be affecting the country as a whole. But I will say that, you know, those things often tend to be related. So we know that economic stress and divorce rates can be correlated, for instance. So I think that you're right that there's not necessarily a huge separation between the personal and the political. And this is just another example of that.
All right. And here, the third insight is sort of almost the most, is the one I think that people get really worried about when they talk about worst case scenarios, with Donald Trump being, for instance, in the general election. Right. And this is sort of the one where if people feel sufficiently scared, non-authoritarians can act like authoritarians. So this is like the scenario where there's a major terrorist attack in the United States in mid-October, right? I mean, this is the one where you start getting non-authoritarians acting like authoritarians.
That's right. And we've seen this in history. So political scientists studied the U.S. electorate after the September 11th attacks, and they found very widespread support for a while for policies that are more typically associated with authoritarians. So things like, you know, support for what the government called enhanced interrogation, the rest of us would call torture, support for, profiling of people in airports based on their ethnicity, things like that. People were very afraid, and support for those kind of policies goes up at times when people are very afraid. And I agree that, you know, it's very frightening. But it's also a reminder that we shouldn't be demonizing authoritarian voters as somehow extremely different from the rest of us. What they really are is more scared, but any of us could be scared.
Well, is it that, I mean, they're more scared, or they have a, I mean, I guess they're more scared, but they have a lower threshold for what scares them.
Yeah, and it's also just a different threshold. So it is, you know, I, as it happens, score pretty low on this authoritarianism scale. I get pretty excited about social change and diversity, and so those things just don't frighten me. But for authoritarians, they really value kind of the status quo. They value conformity. They value order. So they see things like outsiders coming into their communities as a threat to what they care about, because one of the things they care about is things staying the same.
Right.
It seems threatening to them in a way that it wouldn't otherwise.
Yeah, I want to be fair about this in terms of, like, you know, we can have qualitatively differences, but I mean, quantitatively speaking, is there any research? Do non-authoritarians simply are afraid of less things? I mean, is there a scenario where, I mean, I guess except for, let's say, just, you know, the idea of Donald Trump winning, I guess, would not be scary to authoritarians. It may be to some non-authoritarians. Right. But outside of something that narrow, is it a fair statement to say that authoritarians are afraid of more things?
I really think that it's a better way to think about it is that they are afraid of different things. But I think, you know, that because there's this kind of social aspect that they are afraid of that non-authoritarians are not. And I think that's a little bit more of a precise way to think about it. But it is true. Like, there's this source of fear and anxiety for them that there isn't for other people. So when I talked to Mark Hetherington, who is one of the researchers who has studied this issue in the most depth, he said that a lot of it really comes down to having a lower threshold of trust generally for other people. So, you know, if you're an authoritarian, you are maybe more threatening to you to have kind of more people in less predictable scenarios because you don't trust people as much. You find them more frightening, and the more different they are, the more kind of alien their ways seem to you, the more frightening that is.
And okay. So, this stuff is, you know, I mean, so much of the way that we talk about authoritarians, I mean, you could listen to Rush Limbaugh, as I have had for far, far too long and far too much. But this is basically what he is has been telling people for years, is just pointing out different threats to them and sort of, I guess, you know, making sure that that trust boundary is not crossed. In other words, making sure that there is a divide between any inclination people who listen to him have to perhaps give the benefit of doubt to any, or to even, recognize and not stifle that self-doubt that might come in, like, hey, there could be something too. You know, maybe I shouldn't feel threatened by this. I mean, it's really fascinating in that way. And so you have these issues about authoritarians, and you guys set up a your own poll. Tell us about that and what you were looking to do.
So we did a fairly large poll with a media and polling company called Morning Consult of American voters. And what we were trying to do is basically just test this theory. We wanted to find out if it was true that authoritarianism correlated strongly with support for Trump. We also wanted to see if it would prove true in our own polling that authoritarians skewed Republican, that they were more worried than non-authoritarians about various types of social change. And we also wanted to see what their policy preferences looked like. And what we found was basically all of that was true. Scoring high on authoritarianism, so people who answered either three or four of the parenting questions with the authoritarian answer, was very strongly predictive of voting for Trump. I think in our polling, the only thing that came close to that was having a low level of education, But when I shared our results with some of these researchers and they ran various tests on it, and they agreed that this was a pretty strong correlation. And the other thing that we found was it was true that authoritarians were more concerned about various types of threats, but they fell into a couple of particular categories. So authoritarians were more concerned than non-authoritarians about threats that kind of arose out of foreign-seeming people. So the governments of Iran and Russia, for instance, and terrorist organizations like ISIS, people who scored highly on authoritarianism were much, much more likely to say that those things threatened them personally. They were comparatively less concerned about things like car accidents, which actually do probably pose a greater danger to most people living in the United States, just statistically, but they didn't feel as worried about those. And then the same with social change. So we asked people about a long list of things like, same-sex couples being allowed to get married, Muslims building mosques in American cities, etc. And we asked them to rate whether they were good or bad for the country. And people who scored highly on authoritarianism were much more likely to rate those kind of social issues as being bad for the country. And vice versa, people who scored low were much likely, more likely to rate them high as good for the country.
Now, Amanda, let me just stop you here for a minute. And because you are, as a reporter, I think that you are more measured than I am, and you are also, I think, just probably have a more generous heart than I do. But when I hear somebody say, I am more personally afraid of ISIS, presuming they're in the country, right, and they're not actually on the front lines, I'm more afraid of ISIS than I am of dying into a car accident. My reaction to that, and you need to sort of just, how would you dissuade me from this? That is like, ungenerously is delusion. And generously is just like a phobia. Like I'm afraid of being eaten by a spider. In terms of like my capacity to measure what is real. Right? Because there is a real threat that, if my kid goes outside that he could get, it goes into a car, he could get into a car accident. But there is really no statistical, there's a slight possibility, I guess, but that he could get blown up by ISIS. How do you dissuade me from that perspective? Or is it just like, that's just a function of maybe there's a test for people like me who are just a little more cynical?
I don't think it's necessarily cynicism. I would say that I personally am actually very afraid of car accidents. I don't have a car. I don't drive. It's not familiar to me. So car accidents actually seem pretty scary. And
statistically speaking, they should be more.
I actually, don't spend much time in a car. So I'm probably not actually at a huge amount of risk from car accidents. But I would say that it really is an indication of kind of not just the kind of quantum of the risk, but what risks are particularly frightening to people. So car accidents are certainly, as you said, much more likely to hurt somebody who is an American living in the United States. They're pretty dangerous, and they happen a lot. But people, I think, have a greater sense of control, perhaps even a greater sense of control than they should, over whether they're going to get in a car accident, because, mm-hmm. You're in your car, you can steer away from it. And I think that is reassuring to some people. And also we asked about car accidents. We didn't ask about reckless drivers.
Right.
So we weren't asking about the people. And one of the things that research in authoritarianism suggests is that they are more afraid of people than things. They're less concerned about things like car accidents. When I spoke to Professor Weiler, he also said they tend to be less concerned about climate change. That wasn't something that we tested for. But again, it's something that is not a specific threat from an unfamiliar or frightening person. It's kind of a more general physical phenomenon. And so that is just a very different type of psychological disposition, I think, in terms of what seems scary.
All right. So let me ask you, there's a couple more questions here. And getting back to that specific breakdowns of by party, because, I mean, I think this is like, this is the $64,000 question is, you know, what percentage of people, assuming no horrific event that would create an authoritarian reaction in non-authoritarians. What you say 75% of Democrats are non-authoritarian. Does that mean that there's 25% of Democrats out there that could respond to an authoritarian message?
So I would actually say that I am less confident in the results for Democrats than I am for Republicans, because Republicans skew white, and the four-question authoritarianism measure is actually more precise when it's used on white respondents. And if you think about that, you can sort of imagine why a question about, you know, is it, how important is it for your child to be kind of obedient and responsive right. to authority, that could have kind of different connotations if you're a minority in this country than if you're a white person. So I think there are some understandable reasons to be a little bit skeptical of that. But the kind of basic question that you're asking is, are there a lot of authoritarians in the Democratic Party? The answer is yes, but it's not a majority by any means. And there are many more of them in the Republican Party. So in our sample, I think more than 60% of the Republican voters who responded to our survey, I think more than 60% of the sample scored as somewhat high or very high authoritarian. And I think that's a function of the kind of polarization over time that these researchers have been studying.
To what extent do, and because I don't think this was addressed, and I wonder if it came up in your reporting, but what extent is this taught? In other words, like, I mean, and that's what's sort of fascinating about the parenting questions, right? Because, you know, particularly African Americans have a, and minorities, you know, broadly speaking, have a different relationship with, you know, police, let's say, in the country. So the idea of like, you know, I'm not going to have that talk with my son, that, apparently a lot of, African-American fathers have to have, and mothers have to have with their sons and daughters, which is, you know, if you see a cop, you know, make sure, that you are, you know, curiosity goes out the window, you're well behaved and whatnot. But I wonder if it's also taught on the other side. I mean, in other words, like, is this reinforced? I mean, left to their own devices, would these authoritarians, if they had been starved of media and starved of other institutions, or is this something that is taught?
I think that there it does seem to be a kind of taught component of it. And I guess you could also say a cultural component. For instance, authoritarianism correlates pretty highly with being less educated, which doesn't necessarily mean that one causes the other, but it kind of at least suggests that as you become more educated, you maybe become less concerned about change in the world and kind of more able to engage with newer, different ideas and people without feeling quite as threatened by them. And which you can sort of imagine, right? Like a classroom can be a pretty safe environment to encounter those kinds of things. And once you've done it there, it might be easier to do it in the outside world. And so I think to some extent it is absolutely taught. It can be cultural. But like all of these things, there could also just be a basic personality component.
Right. So, and what also I found fascinating, and this leads me to sort of the I guess the broadly speaking, the final questions, as it were. What do we do about this? I mean, what I found really interesting was that when the other Republican candidates, or well, I guess I also want to ask that question, like, you know, in the absence of Trump, who would they have gone to? But what was interesting is that, you know, you talked about when the other candidates tried to echo Trump as a way of dissuading his followers, they would inevitably enhance the fear that Trump's followers are feeling, and Trump is just a better solution to those fears from their perspective, right? Because of the divide between, you know, sort of having the fears and sort of the action component of what they want to respond to that. I mean, just talk about that dynamic. And I'm also curious, you know, is Ted Cruz the guy who they would have gone to if it hadn't been for Trump? Or do these people just stay home and say, oh, I'm just going to sit this one out because there's nobody up there talking about really addressing this in a draconian way?
So I think to kind of take, there were a bunch of questions in there, so I'll try to hit them all. I think the first thing that you pointed out is right, which is that even though these other candidates are trying to kind of get in on the authoritarian style, particularly when they talk about foreign policy, and when they talk about things like immigration by Muslims to the U.S. or Syrian refugees, they're not really able to out-authoritarian Donald Trump. So to the extent that they're kind of reinforcing the voters' views that this is the kind of leadership that's necessary, they're not doing a very good job of convincing them that they're the people to provide it. So I think that's part of what's going on here. You also asked what we would be seeing if Trump was not a candidate. And I think that we would be seeing probably fairly similar campaigns by people like Cruz and Rubio, because there is this authoritarian kind of group of voters within the Republican primary electorate, and they are looking for a candidate who will offer them these kinds of policies. But I think that Trump has certainly dragged things further to the extreme with his just real extreme rhetoric on a lot of these issues.
And so what happens? The scenario Trump loses. I mean, I do think he is sort of at least to some degree uniquely situated to capitalize on this, because he also, it's not just his authoritarianism, right? I mean, at least in the Republican Party, the idea of a CEO president and the idea of wealth being a sign of moral righteousness or just simply righteousness in some way has also been ingrained, at least in the Republican voter's mind, it seems to me, for, you know, at the very least 20 years.
I would say that's maybe part of it, but, you know, I certainly found, at least in our polling, that the kind of classic Republican economic policies, things like free trade or, cutting taxes on high-earning individuals, were not nearly as popular with authoritarians.
I'm not suggesting
some of the kind of authoritarian policies, like a forceful overseas foreign policy.
But I'm not talking about policies. I'm just talking about character. You know, I mean, we have been told, right? I mean, George W. Bush was the CEO president, and then and then we had, I mean, McCain, I guess, was a slight step away from that, but we had Mitt Romney. I mean, this is not, I think the idea of a billionaire being up on stage with these other people who are trying to, you know, the sunny side of Republicanism, right, is that we can all get wealthy. Well, Paul Ryan's brown bag makes you feel bad if you get a brown, if you get a free lunch from school. Well, I mean, here's Donald Trump. He doesn't just bring a non-free lunch to school. I mean, he has his catered. And so he's all those things that that the Republicans, which I think is an overlay on that notion of authoritarianism. But so assuming to a certain extent,
I think, it also just helps to be really, really rich if you're running for president. It means that you are much more able to be independent of the kind of Republican establishment. You don't need them to help you raise money.
That's right.
But being a billionaire has its benefits.
Yes. And he does. He can't. But he also, I mean, I really do think like there's a lot to be said for that 747 when it pulls in. It says Trump on it. And he just looks like, you know, his isn't quite the Air Force One, but it's better than everybody else's. I mean, that's for sure.
Right.
So let me ask you this. I mean, what happens to these authoritarians? Where do they, does it end if Trump loses in either the primary or the general, or do they double down?
I don't think it does.
No,
I don't think it does. You know, I think that these people, they're still around. They still have their preferences. It's, you know, Trump, if nothing else, has shown that a candidate can do extremely well by appealing to these kind of voter preferences. And I think that the Republican Party has shown that it really doesn't have an answer to a candidate like Trump, who is willing to kind of jettison the main planks of the kind of classic conservative economic platform in exchange for some kind of basic economic nationalism and this kind of authoritarian bluster. The Republican Party hasn't been able to do anything about that. And I think that the next time a candidate wants to run and make a national name for themselves, they're not going to forget that this really helped Donald Trump do well in this campaign.
Yeah. I mean, and why just national? I mean, if I'm a congressman, right, who's watching Trump, this is a model, it seems to me. I mean, and if I mix the economic policies of you know, what is sort of typical, I should be two for two, right? I mean,
absolutely.
I mean, can you imagine?
I think that's right. And I think, you know, particular districts may have more authoritarian voters because of their kind of demographics. They may be under more stress because of their economic situation, and that would make it a kind of particularly fruitful option for that kind of politician.
Lastly, let me ask you this. Do you think that Trump would be as successful if he did have more doctrinaire conservative economic policies? In other words, if he wasn't talking, I mean, I guess he has to talk about trade as being problematic, right? Because it's the outside, mm-hmm. The sneaky Chinese, I think he said at one point or whatever, you know, sort of taking advantage of us, and the sort of the weak need who won't stop the Chinese from doing that. But could he have fashioned a more a doctrinaire conservative or Republican policies and done this, or is it really come to loggerheads when it sort of increases the fear?
So I think that it's hard for me to say what he could have done, but it does seem pretty clear that those kind of breaks with establishment conservatism have really helped his candidacy. So one is, as you point out, it's a way to kind of talk about outsiders as villains and paint kind of foreign trade as the problem that's at the root of people's economic woes works very well for him. Another is it means that he doesn't have to kind of limit himself in the kinds of populist policies he can say that he would pursue. And, you know, especially among kind of poorer voters under more economic stress, it's not really popular to say you're going to do something like cut healthcare or limit Social Security, because a lot of those voters really need those programs. And then the last thing that I think it allows him to do is paint himself as that much more of an outsider, kind of standing up to the political establishment. And that is something that has made him look even more powerful and even more kind of brave to his supporters, that he's willing to do that. So I think that's been a real benefit to his candidacy.
It's interesting too, the way that trust plays in this, because I think one of the things that it's that as much as it makes him an outsider, I think it creates trust in the Republican voter when they see him say something that is heresy. And regardless of whether it's policy or not, you know, just even George Bush was president on 9/11. When he says something that is heretical, that theoretically should hurt him in the campaign, I think that signals to his potential, supporters, he's really talking straight with us. Even if I disagree with him, I can trust him. And it's interesting, you know, sort of when you balance that against sort of the authoritarian, proclivity to distrust people.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think that it makes him seem like a leader who's kind of strong enough to steamroll any institution or norm that would stand in his way. And I think that really appeals to people.
Well, this has all been very encouraging, Amanda. But
everything is great. It's all going to go really well.
There we go. But it's also very fascinating. Thank you so much for your time today. Amanda Taub from Vox.com, Rise of the American Authoritarianism. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much, Sam.
Here is, this is also great. This is like an ad for the hotel, right? They shot this. Where'd they shoot this?
They're touring his new hotel in D.C. on location. And now it just becomes.
Apparently Trump's like Mar-a-Lago has like doubled revenue over the course of his campaign. So here's, that's the problem is he's finding this is actually making him money. And so here is him walking through the tour. Listen to this. This is clip number 3.
And what are you going to have here? A hotel with about how many rooms?
This will be almost 300 rooms. It'll be super luxury. It'll be suites, 2 restaurants, one of the biggest ballrooms in the city and the largest luxury ballroom in the city.
Pause it. Now, Andy, I want to tell you, this is not an ad for the hotel. This is ostensibly a news segment that Greta Van Susteren's doing.
No, I swear to God. I thought this was a commercial.
No, it is not. I swear to God. I started from the beginning.
What are you going to have here? A hotel with about how many rooms?
This will be almost 300 rooms. It'll be super luxury. It'll be suites, 2 restaurants, one of the biggest ballrooms in the city and the largest luxury ballroom in the city. Washington has never had, the hotel people who I love are going to kill me for saying this, but Washington has never had a really luxury hotel. This will be it. This will be the most luxurious hotel in the United States, easily.
Who is this?
This is Melania, my wife. What a first lady. She would be the all-time first lady.
Do you think you would like to be first lady?
Well, it's too early to say.
He's wild man, isn't he?
He is. He's fantastic. What he does, it's unbelievable. His energy, his passion, and for this country and for everything what he does.
Is it safe to say Donald is never dull?
Yes, he's never dull.
What news segment has music that's like, I got the butt, the trump, trump, booga, boom, bang, bang, the trick, the trank, the trank, trank?
It's insane. It's insane.
But a big, what are we looking at here? A big, booga, check, a chang, chang.
We could. I bet you if somebody tracked that music down, that's probably like the title of it. It's like one of those like sort of like industrial packages, like upbeat sales. You know, it's probably the name of that. That song.
Luxury apartments.
He's a wild man, isn't he?
Wow!
Oh my God, it's my wife. She's in the hallway. I didn't even know she was here. It's a total surprise.
This is totally, totally impromptu.
Totally.
Too soon to say. It is too soon to say.
Oh God.
It is too early to say.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program the Eastern Professor of Political Economy at the Watson Institute at Brown University, Mark Blythe. Mark, welcome back to the program.
Nice to talk to you again, Sam.
Now, obviously, we're here to talk about Brexit. You were on the program, I guess it was in 2013, talking about your book on austerity. And in many respects, the chickens came home to roost, didn't they, in a way?
They certainly did. I mean, if you think about what's going on in Britain, are we honestly saying that people in the pubs and places like Sunderland are sitting there plowing over the IMF or the OECD report, listening to the chatter in the financial classes about the risk assets and what's going to happen? No, they're basically looking at a life that's been built over 20 years, whereby after the financial crisis, what was already a precarious existence became one where the Chancellor of the Exchequer, our Treasury Secretary, stands up and says, well, we have to cut public spending. Oh, terrible, because we bailed out all those banks. And, like, of course, they didn't really make that link. But people can put two and two together. And when they see that basically the whole financial system and everybody with assets gets bailed out, and the cost of that, as I said in my book, was going to be lower public spending, reduced life chances, and more fractured lives for everyone at the bottom end of the income distribution, then given any opportunity to express the frustration, they're going to take it. And that's what the Brexit vote was in large part.
I mean, so let me see. So in other words, I mean, this is the clearest opportunity that people had to basically register their frustration. And it was not necessarily an assessment of the implications of EU policy as much as it was saying, we don't like what's happening, and this is the closest lever that we can pull to basically register, to raise that flag.
Absolutely. I mean, the American version of this is Trumpism, right? It's exactly the same phenomenon where you got a bunch of people who feel, with real justification, that one of the parties has led them down the garden path of, honestly, just give me more tax cuts and it'll eventually trickle down to you and it'll be awesome. That clearly hasn't worked for them. And the other one has said, globalization, trade agreements, yeah, absolutely, it's all going to work out fine. You'll be retrained, only they weren't. You'll be reskilled, only you weren't. They were basically left to fend for themselves in minimum wage jobs. And of course, given the opportunity to stick one up at the establishment, they did. Let's think about, get away from Brexit, think about Trump. How does Trump happen? Trump is a joke character. He's like a cartoon character version of what a rich guy should be like. And he's on the ballot. And establishment Republican after establishment Republican comes up. And the Republican primary guys go, no chance, we're not dealing with any of these guys. This is about frustration. This is about anger. This is about being left behind. There's a fantastic paper by an economist called Branko Milanovic on this, and he has a wonderful graph in it, and it shows who has basically done well in the global economy over the past 30 years. And if you're in a really poor country, you've went from $2 a day to $4 a day. You had 100% growth, right? Big in a place like Chad. If you're in China, you went from 35th to 55th percentile. That's real income gains. That's 400 million people out of poverty. The poorest person in the United States starts in the 55th percentile of the global income distribution. And everybody from the 55th down to the 87th has basically lost relative to both the poorest and also, guess what, the top 10%. So I was asked at work to do a video where I could explain very, very quickly, very pithily what this is. And I got it down to 24 seconds. You want to hear what it is?
Please.
All right, here we go. When 80% of the time, 80% of the people are told by the top 20% that everything that they want is what they should want too, but 80% of their lived experience tells them they're being sold a bill of goods, don't be surprised when they say no.
Right. And that's basically what we witnessed with this vote.
That's it. This is what you're seeing everywhere. The collapse of the center parties, the lack of faith in governing authorities, the rise, if you will, of completely fact-free politics. I mean, let's give the Republicans credit. They pioneered that genre 20 years ago and have been mining it wonderfully ever since. But now we've got to the point where anyone who raises facts, actual factual objections, is shouted down because facts are just constructions and they don't really matter. Now, is this because people are stupid or people have real reasons to mistrust the elites? The elites who in our country want to nudge them into better behaviors, who want to police them in certain ways, who want them to behave in a nice way so they don't threaten the established order. And when they do, they're called populists. They're called racists. Now, this is not to say that they're not some populists and indeed some racists there. But this is, again, the denigration of the real experiences of the American working class and how the Democrats in particular have basically sold them down the river.
All right. So just staying in the context of Brexit for just a bit here, give me your sense of how much of, I mean, clearly there's a response to a lived reality. How much of that lived reality is a function of in Great Britain? How much of that lived reality is a function of the euro policies, the euro dollar versus conservative and center right liberal policies?
Yeah, so how much of this is to do with Europe and how much is domestic politics that was really their mess to sort out, right? So my shtick on this goes like this. The euro is a disaster, but the EU is a fantastic idea. The EU has taken the rule of law and democracy from the Atlantic to the Balkans. It was fantastically successful. particularly in the period of post-communism. Then they stuck a monetary instrument where one size fits none, and you end up with a deflationary situation which causes mass unemployment, which is where we are now. Now, here's the thing about the Brits. The Brits didn't have any of that. They have the pound. They have an exclusion from ever joining the euro. They were completely in the sweet spot. They're a large economy. They were in the single market. They had their own currency, so they didn't have to worry about all the deflationary dynamics that Spain and France and Greece face vis-a-vis the German export machine. They don't have to worry about any of the silly rules being written in the fiscal compact and all this nonsense that they've written in Europe. And they were able to influence everything. So what they've done, because of the way that the politics of this was sold, was it was all about regaining sovereignty and regaining autonomy. And yes, of course, Britain has ceded sovereignty to Europe in key areas. But let me explain what that concretely means. Imagine you're a British manufacturer. You want to sell stuff in Europe. So you could have one common standard, let's say for environmental protection on cars, or we could have 28 different standards, which would make your costs much worse. So Brussels harmonizes that. And this is seen by the Brexiters as this terrible imposition on British sovereignty. Now, what this really comes down to is immigration. And we should take a separate moment to talk about immigration and migration, because this is a very real concern. But most of what was said about by the Brexiteers about Europe simply is demonstrably not true. And most of it fell within the competency of the British government to do something about inequality, stagnant wages, but they chose to do nothing about it. And they were quite happy to let Europe take the blame, right, even though they weren't in the euro.
Right. So that's a function of basically this is a fig leaf for our policies, which are going to benefit a very narrow bandwidth of our constituents and our donor class, if you will. And yet we get to blame Europe for it.
Think about a year ago, right? The guy who was the Conservative Party, the ruling party in Britain's welfare affairs spokesman, quit his job. Because he basically accused his own government of doing class warfare on the poor because it was electorally popular and because the poor would never vote for them.
Right. And so
you don't get more explicit than that.
All right. Well, so just explain to people how the euro could have been problematic. I mean, it doesn't seem like obviously because Great Britain is not using the euro, how it hurts these other countries and creates these deflationary pressures. Because I'm looking at, like, for instance, youth unemployment in Europe. Now, this is granted, this is from, I guess, almost a year ago. But in Spain and Greece, in Croatia, in Italy, above 40% of the youth unemployment.
Trust me, it hasn't gotten any better, Sam. It's exactly the same. All right, so think about it this way, a very simple way to think about this. So imagine that you have this big financial shock, and it suddenly turns out that the Greeks have been lying about their budget deficit. Now, the Greek economy back in 2010 was the size of Alabama. It's now one-third smaller, but nonetheless, that was the size of it. So if Alabama went bust, do you think the United States would go crazy and go into a massive freak-out about it? Absolutely not, because what had happened is people would leave Alabama, and alternatively, there would be financial flows that would come in through the private sector or go out to other areas, and there would be an adjustment in the local budget. Well, that happens because you've got one country, and you have fiscal transfers, and you have capital markets. And when you live in Arkansas and you move to New York, it's not as if you lose your pension. But Europe is very much an incomplete project. So when you got this shock, and it turned out that the big banks in Europe were using these sovereign debt instruments as collateral in their transactions, and they were losing value, suddenly you were looking at a possibility of a massive banking crisis. So that had to be cauterized. So they did this. This is the turn to austerity, et cetera. Fine. Okay, let's go forward 5 years. Why are they still in the doldrums of massively high unemployment? Think about the following. If you're Germany and your supply chain for all your stuff goes into Eastern Europe, then effectively what you're saying to German workers is don't ask for a wage increase, because if you do, I will move my stuff to Romania, and all the parts suppliers are already there. Why do you think you can get a BMW, an incredible car in the United States, for $35,000? Because it's made, the components for it are made in a place which is incredibly cheap and also very skilled. So as the EU expanded eastward and as these countries became part of the supply chain, then they were able to make German parts in particular very, very cheap. So the northern exporters, Eastern Europe, Germany, Holland to a certain extent, they were all running surpluses in the global economy. They're earning money from their exports. Now, if somebody's running a surplus, somebody else has to be running a deficit. It all sums to zero. So that means that France, who's good on services exports but pretty horrible in manufacturing exports, and Spain, who does agricultural exports, they should be allowed to run a deficit to complement the surplus. But they wrote a bunch of rules in 2012 called the Fiscal Compact that says you have to balance your budget, something American conservatives like a lot. Now, if I have to balance my budget when somebody else is running a surplus, the only way I can do that is to permanently contract my economy. So what you're doing is you're causing contraction and deflation in the non-surplus economies to balance out the surplus that you're banking against the rest of the world. That's not good. It's not good economics, and it's certainly not good politics.
And it doesn't seem to be able to end, right? I mean, that's the model. That's the new normal, right? I mean, is that
This is the model. I mean, the crazy thing about it is, like, you know, you try telling the Germans they're not going to run 7% of GDP as a budget surplus, as a trade surplus, and they'll be like, why the hell would we not want to do that? And from their point of view, it's totally rational, because at the end of the day, the EU is not a country. They are not accountable for the Greek unemployment level. They're just not.
I mean, just so, you know, to just reiterate this so that people can sort of get this concept. I mean, it's almost as if, like, you know, you look at the NFL. There was a long time attempt to establish parity in the NFL. But the fact is, if you have one team that's going to be 14-0 or 16-0 over the course of the season, you have to make up those losses on other teams. And
Exactly. And this is also why, to take an NFL analogy, right, the weak teams get the best picks. Now imagine if you end up with a draft system whereby the winningest teams could just continue to pick the best players. All the returns go to one side. There's no way to balance out the other side. Exactly.
So, I mean, how much I guess the odd thing about this is that it's not a particularly salient wake-up call in terms of what's problematic about the euro, is it, or is it not? Because The Great Britain wasn't a function.
Wasn't even in it.
Right, it wasn't a
they
function.
They weren't even in it.
So what? Well, all right. Before we get to what happens next for the Euro project, I mean, what happens? I mean, what do you anticipate happening in terms of Great Britain? And I'm curious as to where you place, where what your sense is of the various sort of political actors here, because it appears that. That Cameron is basically has sort of reneged on his promised sort of, I guess, sort of the implied threat that, like, we're going to institute Article 50, which would get this process going of exiting the EU, and I'm not going to resign. And he sort of has done a complete 180 on both those promises. In other words, like, I'm leaving this hot potato for the guy who sort of screwed me over in the first place. Or whose bait I took, Boris Johnson, and you know, here's a huge mess. Let somebody else deal with it. I mean, so we're
So think about it this way. First of all, like, how can I put it? It would be great if the British governing classes had a spine between them to share. Right? I mean, I've been in the United States for 25 years now. So there we go. I mean, I'm a U.S. citizen, and I kiss the ground every day for the day that I joined this wonderful republic. And I left Britain because of a woman. Her name was Margaret Thatcher. But at the end of the day, I'll say one thing for Thatcher. She was a real leader. She knew what the hell she was doing. She was in politics because she believed in things. What we've had since the days of Tony Blair in particular are a bunch of careerists who join up, round trip the public sector, learn some skills, and then go off and hawk it to the private sector. Practically every member of the Labour front bench from the last government now works in the financial sector for a bank. Mm-hmm. It's a disgrace. So, you know, the fact that Cameron, a man who looks like he was carved out of cream cheese and baked in the oven, has finally said, I don't really know what I'm doing. This is a really stupid idea. That his chancellor has said, I'm not touching this with a barge pole. And then the Labour Party, in classic leftist fashion, has decided to have an internal house-cleaning coup d'etat and general self-destruction party at exactly the wrong moment. It's just classic. I mean, it's incredible. It's the meltdown of one of the most stable countries around. I mean, it's one thing to exit the EU in 1 week, but it's another one to lose against Iceland, lose a football manager, lose a credit rating, and also manage to do Brexit. I mean, that's the quadfecta. That's incredible.
And so, I mean, so give me a sense of what happens next. I see that George Osborne just hours ago said taxes will have to be raised, spending cuts. I mean, basically coming from more austerity. Buddy,
well,
then
it.
He says,
sort of like,
I'm not going to do it. I'm getting out of here before any of that stuff goes down, it sounds like.
Well, but this, I mean, the one of the really interesting splits in here isn't just sort of, you know, the left behind by globalization and Europeanization versus the 20% who have made out like bandits. There's a huge intergenerational split in this. And then you see exactly the same thing in American politics, right? The young want to stay in this case, right? And but at the same time, they don't vote as much as old people. And the old people want out because they want to protect their assets. And a large number of them don't like difference and don't like foreigners. So, you know, take a typical example of an up-and-coming 30-something couple. They buy a house in an area of London that's filled with immigrants because, of course, this area is going to improve. Well, not anymore, because all the immigrants are probably going to be terrified as to what happens next. Investment slowing down, the neighborhood's going to start to decay, and that huge mortgage they took on is suddenly going to be underwater. So on a micro level, for the people who voted to remain, the costs of this are absolutely enormous. Let's not even get into the really complex issues like science and technology funding. £5 billion of that a year came from Europe. What happens to that now? Let's think about Nissan. They have a huge plant in the north of England. Huge numbers of people voted to exit the EU. That's where Nissan makes its cars. They make 10% of their global production in the northeast of England. If their profit margins go down because Britain has to negotiate a deal now where they have to put tariffs on their product, they'll just shift their production to France. It's a question of how much, which foot do you want to shoot yourself in and which gun do you want to use?
I mean, The short-term, mid-term, and long-term prospects for Great Britain seem dim. Is so much of this going to be just sort of like, how do we unwind this relationship?
Let's go back to something you said, Sam, right? Because this is the one hope that we've got, and I'm not that hopeful. Now, you know, I'm against the euro. I'm a strong critic of the euro. I don't think it should have been introduced. I think it maybe fits one or two countries. But Europe itself has its own problems. But we're not talking about Europe. We're talking about the UK. The UK didn't have to do any of this and is now going to negotiate a situation that's going to be worse than the one it found in. And it's going to cause ructions economically and politically, globally and locally because of this. So it's completely unnecessary. Now, what is Cameron doing by pushing this out to, it was October, it is now September. He's trying to induce as much buyer's remorse as possible into everybody who voted to leave. Now, at the end of the day, here's a weird thing about Britain. It doesn't have a written constitution. This is very important. Now, because it doesn't have a written constitution, parliamentary sovereignty is the only rule that matters. If Parliament doesn't vote on it, it doesn't happen. Nigel Farage, one of the main leaders of Get Out, doesn't have a seat in Parliament. And the main parties, even though they're basically collapsing and infighting at this point, have to actually vote on this to get it done. There is no executive authority like there is in the United States where the president writes an executive order and X happens. So Cameron's not going to press the button for Article 50. There's going to be elections. They're going to build up as much buyer's remorse as possible. And they're going to try and overturn this. This is what the internal game, I think, is. Now, here's where it gets really interesting, right? If you do that, the 51% who voted to get out will go nuts because they will see this as hijacking a vote. But that vote was merely advisory. There is no such thing as a legally binding referendum in the United Kingdom. Parliamentary sovereignty is the only thing that matters. So on the one hand, you could do this, but the ructions will be huge. Now, here's where it gets really interesting. If you do that, if you say, OK, we're going to go with this, as Cameron says he's doing at least, we're going to respect the 51% who voted to get out. What about the 61% in Scotland who said we'd like to stay in?
Right.
What about Northern Ireland? Because this is where this gets really interesting, because so Northern Ireland leaves and Scotland leaves. Where do you put the nuclear weapons? What happens to NATO's commitment from Britain? What happens to Britain's G7 position? It dies. What happens to its UN Security Council seat? It goes into question. So for all the things that people are worried about in terms of getting back sovereignty from Europe, yeah, good luck with that. You've made Great Britain so much less great.
And so theoretically what could happen in Parliament is that everybody just keeps pointing to other people. I mean, it just sort of feels like everybody's just going to take an extended vacation and wait until hopefully nobody remembers that they were supposed to vote on this this article to initiate the actual exit. Because, I mean, there the distinct feeling I get is that everybody was just sort of bluffing. And, you know, like all of them were all just sort of bluffing. Nobody thought this was actually going to happen because they don't seem from Boris Johnson on down. None of them seem to really know what they're supposed to do next.
There's no plan. You're absolutely right. But, you know, this is why people should be incredibly worried about Trump. It's the same thing. You can have this spasm of rejection of the liberal and conservative elites, and it, God knows it's justified. But what happens when you put that guy in charge? And it's the same thing with Boris Johnson. All he wanted to do was dethrone his old buddy Cameron as if it was a debating society match and get control of the Tory party, instead of which he's put Britain on the brink of an economic and political disaster for nothing more than personal envy, ambition, and just being, how can I put this politely, and just being Boris.
What happens? Let's assume for a moment that somehow the inertia continues and Article 51 is passed and Britain begins to extricate itself from the EU. What happens to the EU down the road? I mean, does this send a message to other countries like, look, this is doable, and we're actually getting screwed much more so than Great Britain was? So, you know, if they were a 51-49, we're a 60-40 on this. So, I mean, does this lead to, I mean, I don't know, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years down the road, an incredible increase in instability? Because I imagine you're not going to get back to that period that we had, whatever it was, 20 years ago, where you have the EU, but you don't have the euro.
Right. Well, you know, you might do if the whole thing blows up. All you need is the National Front to get in France, and they want to withdraw from the euro. At that point, it's very questionable whether it can survive as just a kind of German currency union. So, you know, Brexit wasn't meant to happen, it happened, so you never know. All right, but let's think this one through. There's two contradictory forces going on in Europe. On the one hand, you have all the people who have gained from the fact that the centre parties have essentially built a creditor's paradise for the top 20% and instantiated it in the euro. That is the SPD, the German left, the French left. They've all done terribly. Hollande's approval ratings are 11%. George W. Bush was three times more popular going out than Hollande is in office. You have to try hard to be that unpopular. The SPD got 19% in the last regional elections. That's their homeland. The European centre left is dead. It's a corpse, right? So what do you have? You have all of these parties of the left and the right basically eating away at the middle. So the EU institutions, the old guard, the bureaucracy, the Junkers of this world are saying, right, we need to make this unpleasant, we have to make this terrible so it scares people from doing this. Okay, the minute you're trying to build a multi-political union out of fear, you've lost. They need a positive project and they've forgotten what it is. And the reason they've forgotten what it is because they spent the past 8 years since 2008 enforcing a creditor's paradise, which has alienated more and more people from the project as they protected the rights of creditors and turned the screws on theirs. That's what austerity does. So until they come up with an entirely new project, and it's far from clear from me that Juncker and Tusk and the rest of these people in the EU can actually think of an alternative political settlement for Europe and the euro, they really are in trouble. And the left and the right are going to continue, the new left and the new right are going to continue to eat their lunch. So they are in a really, really bad place. And Brexit has basically put this right on their agenda and they can't ignore it.
You've almost answered the next question I had, but before we get to that, when you say the new left and the new right, just give me a sense of who or what you're talking about.
Sure. So go country by country, right? The new right is essentially the Republican establishment is dead in the water. They couldn't get elected if their life depended on it. Trump's taken over. Let's go for the new left here. So what's happening with the British Labour Party? The entire parliamentary party, all the MPs, hate their leader. Their leader was a guy who was put on the ballot basically as a sop to the left, and he ended up getting 60-odd percent of the vote. All the establishment New Labour people, the membership, hate them. They couldn't, some of them couldn't even get into double figures. Now, in the aftermath of Brexit, the parliamentary party has decided to stab their leader in the heart and try and change it and get a new leader. Problem, you need to actually get the membership on board for that, and they're not going to play. So Labour just blew up. The new left in Greece, Syriza, is an obvious example of this. They were the guys that said, no, 61%, we're not doing austerity anymore. Then the ECB turned off liquidity of their banking system, and they said, oh, yeah, all right, we'll do it then, because they had no alternative, thereby undermining democracy and strengthening both the extreme left and the extreme right. Italy, you've got Renzi's in trouble, the centre-left guy, and although he didn't have a breakthrough this time, the five-star movement's still there, the same with Podemos in Spain. In Scotland, the National Front plays a nice game, the Scottish National Party plays a nice game of being the anti-austerity party, mainly because they live off of English transfers, and now that's in doubt. What are they doing? They're screaming like blue murder to get into the EU. Sinn Féin in Ireland. Every country has an example of this. And it goes back to that story I told you. From the 55th percentile to the 87th percentile, people aren't doing well and have actually lost. Their wages have been stagnant. Their costs are going up. The cost to get into college, the cost of healthcare. Meanwhile, your wages, you're living on less and less the whole time. And you're angry and you're fed up with this and you want something different. These people may not offer real solutions, but at least they recognize the problem.
I mean, do you think that I guess the analogy would be, I mean, do you think there's anybody listening? Like, or is there even an anybody there anymore? I mean, the analogy that occurs to me is, that you had 17 or 16 Republican primary challengers aside from Trump, and none of them could coalesce around anything. No one could recognize what was happening, and they all were acting in their own self-interest, which did not include being the one who would take Trump on head on until it was too late. I mean, do we have that same dynamic? Like, there's no one person or one entity or one group that's really at the wheel in any way. So you just have like a series of individuals who share. The only thing they share is just a sense of very, very narrow self-preservation, and there's no one to respond to this.
Well, this goes to my earlier point about leadership. I mean, you know, I was no fan of Mrs. Thatcher, but this wouldn't have happened on her watch. And what we have is, you know, venal self-interest, basic masquerading as a political career. So, you know, this is definitely a large part of the problem. But part of it is you reap what you sow. I mean, if you think about the Republican primaries, they've been throwing red meat to the base for 20 years, right? So, you know, welfare queens, and then it's Mexicans, and then, you know, remember Mitt Romney's wonderful policy of self-deportation? I mean, what's that? Once you identify other people as the problem, and when you forget, of course, that like if you hermetically sealed the borders tomorrow, somebody's still going to be picking the tomatoes in Florida, and it's not usually going to be the Floridians. So, you know, what happens when that happens? Well, basically nothing changes, and you realize you've been sold a bill of goods, so you go bananas. You lose faith in these people, and they have every reason to do so. This is also affecting the Democrats. Why is it that young people are completely enthused about Clinton's candidacy? Because they look back to the 1990s, not with rose-tinted nostalgia, but as the period in which we had super predators, three strikes and you're out, globalization, the moment when NAFTA was signed. All of us got the Democrats' fingerprints all over it. And this is where, as far as many people are concerned, when the rot set in.
Do you think that there's anybody in the, the financial industry? I mean, do you think that Hillary Clinton has an easier chance, or maybe she doesn't even hear this, but that somebody has an easier chance of saying to Hillary Clinton, like, you know, this is all an indication of just exactly what you cannot get away with? I mean, are there any voices out there? I mean, I guess in this country too, where that are delivering the message in a cohesive way? And do you think that there's any sense that anybody's listening? I mean, I guess I'm asking that question again.
Yeah, I mean, you're going to have to be more specific, Sam. I mean, you know, let's rephrase that one. Is there actually a positive agenda? Well, you could point to Bernie's agenda, but the problem is, with all due respect, Bernie's too old and the people who are voting for him are too young. And the problem with being too young is not enough of you to show up to vote.
Right.
Old people vote, and old people vote for security for their assets. They don't like change. They don't like foreigners. And when moments of uncertainty come along, they tend towards the right rather than the left. So, you know, there is an agenda out there. But, you know, again, let's think about how this plays out. So the one thing's deeply troubling for me about Clinton's candidacy is the whole issue of the Goldman Sachs transcripts. Now, I've spoken to financial conferences. You can have my transcripts if you want. I'm not sure anybody took them, but if you can find them, I'm fine with it. I'll tell them exactly what I'll tell you. It's not a problem. But if you're not willing to release them, what that says to me is you must have been saying something like, we're all in it together. You're the wealth creators. There was too much credit. We need regulation, but we don't want to kill the business. In other words, exactly what they wanted to hear, and
right.
All of which would be deeply damaging if you're meant to be somebody who's going to take these guys on and regulate them in the public interest. So it seems to me that but the political classes are completely compromised and discredited. And the one person who isn't, who's genuinely exciting, and I don't just mean too old in terms of like Bernie's an older guy. I mean, he's old in the sense that his population that he's attracting, people under the age of 35, they are not going to show up in enough numbers, and he's not going to mobilize people on the other side. So, you know, that agenda just isn't going to have resonance at this point. And we see this in the Democratic Party and the primaries, sadly.
I mean, is there an agenda that addresses these issues? I mean, is it coming from anywhere, do you see, in the context of our political landscape?
Not yet. I mean, put it this way. I read the Financial Times every day because I like to know what the 1% are thinking. And for the past several months, the Financial Times was running these series of articles. The robots are coming. And you've seen this all over the place. It's become a meme, right? So imagine how scary this is, right? So you're a working class person. You're in a state in the Midwest. You're working in an industrial job. And whoops, a private equity firm comes in, buys it, dumps credit on the books. Firm goes public. Your job gets shipped abroad. You're good. You adapt. You're fine. You get a job in a call center. That does someone else. It's less wages, but that works. Oh, then your call center gets shipped abroad, right? Well, never mind. There's always Walmart or an Amazon warehouse. Oh, but you know what? You're going to get stunned by a robot soon. This is what you're hearing. Where exactly is any politician, left or right, standing up and saying, you're actually a citizen of the United States. You are sovereign. You are the person that I am here to protect, to help, and empower. And instead of which, I'm trying to buy shares in the robot firm.
In the Financial Times, are they saying, like, are you ever seeing any opinion pieces like, hey, this could be a problem if we bring in all these robots? Or is that awareness?
Absolutely.
Okay.
No. The one thing about the 1% is they're not monolithic. Many of them are deeply worried about this. But when you've set up a system in which market competition means that the first mover advantage is really strong, if I'm in a sector and I robotize, my profits go up. So all the investment comes towards me. You lose out. You're left carrying my lunch bag. The incentive is for everybody to do it.
Right.
And when politicians have basically boxed themselves into a logic of whatever markets want is good and whatever people want is some kind of error, then it's very hard for them to turn around and do anything about this.
Right. We would need some type of instead of government intervention on the side of sort of investing more in those robots, investing more in their people in some fashion.
Exactly. But to do that, you would actually need to engage with the people and not have some manufactured town hall with supporters bust in where you talk about nice, safe issues that you know that the staid middle classes over the age of 55 care about.
Mark Blythe.
I mean, I'll give you an example. We got 30 seconds?
Oh, yeah. We got plenty of time. Continue.
All right. I'm going to give you this one. Go to President Clinton's website and have a look at the list of issues. Now, it's in alphabetical order, which is kind of weird. But the last time I checked, the first one is Alzheimer's. Now, this is a serious problem, but it's an old people's problem. And it's an old people and families problem that is going to get worse over time. But is that really the thing that's animated the concern for people who are like considering voting for Trump? I don't think so.
Right.
The next one is campus sexual assault. This is a huge problem. We've seen that in the recent court decisions. It's absolutely huge, right? But there's lots of people in America who are saying, I can't even think about sending my kid to college because it's so expensive. Now, further down the list, absolutely, Clinton wants to do something about student loans. But it's not going to be the debt forgiveness of $1 trillion of debt that needs to be forgiven to get young people out of that burden. So we're nipping around the edges. We're not addressing the issues straight on. We're trying to do what the Democrats always do, which is to segment the population, target the people who are going to turn out to vote for you. And while that makes electoral sense in terms of winning the electoral game, it's seeding the agenda because there's no united positive vision that people can get behind. There is no equivalent to saying, let's make America great again. And we need someone like that.
Mark Blythe, professor of political economy at the Watson Institute, Brown University. Thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
No problem. Cheers.
We are back on the Majority Report, Air America Radio. We are streaming at airamericaradio.com.